housekeeping note before I introduce Richard Hillworth, who will introduce our speaker, Mr. Trillin. The collection that we began taking up for J.C. Hardaway has now topped $2,200. We will take that up to him next week. Your generosity is stunning and beautiful. If anyone has not yet had a chance to contribute to Mr. Hardaway's Investment Expense Fund, Lola Terry Eli's hat will. And he thought you were getting out of church. The other thing I'd like to do is call up Trip Holmgren of White Lily, who is somewhere here. I would imagine
right there.
Where are you? There you are. Without White Lily's sponsorship, we would not be able to pull this off. They showed deep and abiding commitment to the Southern Freeway Alliance, and we were deeply appreciative.
Thank you very much, John. I think, first and foremost, White Lily needs to thank a few people. And the first is the Barkers, who I can't claim to be a member of this organization since its birth, but I've seen some incredible growth. And I got to tell you, I get the pleasure of going to a number of things like this each year, and this is, in my mind, the premier and the nicest and the best experience that I have each year. Tell me these types of things. And I think John Kidd and Mary Beth Lester really need.
Occupied by my baby brother, it doesn't bother me. Welcome all of you to the food symposium. In order that I might properly and specially represent the city to you, I took a little survey among the some of the employees and the aldermen of the city, and I want to tell you a little bit about that. Superintendent of Buildings and Grounds, Billy Lamb, said to me, Mayor, he actually says Mayor, Billy says Mayor with one syllable. When you ask a fat person his favorite food, that list can be very long, but fried corn with bacon and peppers is my favorite. Alderman Oliver, Public Works Director Dave Bennett likes filet mignon and lobster, respectively, and dislike boiled okra. A lot of people dislike boiled okra, apparently. Brussels sprouts. Janice Alderman and Alderman Pat Patterson to enjoy turnip greens cooked with fatback and cornbread hot enough to melt real butter. But, Pat says, I don't care for steamed cauliflower with a side of broccoli or some other concocted health substance. Might serve you to know that while in Oxford, if you run into trouble and find yourself before the formidable presence of Police Chief Steve Bramlett, just remember these two words, fried chicken. From the chief down to all of our second graders with their Wonder Bread crushed shorn bologna sandwiches, Oxford sends its heartiest gastronomic wishes. I occasionally complain about the headaches that this job gives me. It's the first time it's given me a stomachache. And a word about City Hall itself. It's a wonderful place to work, I've found. There are about 250 employees in the city, 50 or 60 of whom work in or routinely come through City Hall, and one of the centers of activity there is food. They cook for each other's birthdays, on holidays. There are two stoves in City Hall, both of which were donated by Whirlpool, a local industrial facility here. And two or three days out of the week, you can walk in there and smell turnip greens and corn casserole or chicken spaghetti, sweet potato pie. It's just a wonderful place. And places, workplaces that associate, you know, food with the people who work there, they become like family. So it's a great experience for me. My privilege here this morning is to introduce Calvin Trillin. Mr. Trillin was known growing up in Kansas City by his family, I believe, as Buddy or Bud, and I want him and everyone else to know that herewith he shall be known in the state of Mississippi as Bud, because, well, Bud, it just comes so easy for us. He's a graduate of Yale, a writer for Time. He's a longtime contributor to The New Yorker, where his writing there has left an imprint on the magazine's personality in the way as was done by legendary New Yorker writers such as James Thurber, William Maxwell, E.B. White, and others. He's the author of 21 books, fiction, essays, memoirs, journalism, both humorous and hard, travel writing, and, of course, culinary reportage, most famously his Tummy Trilogy, including American Fried, Alice, Let's Eat, and Third Helping. In the wake of recent events celebrating the 40th anniversary of desegregation here at the University of Mississippi, it is worth noting Bud's first book, published in 1964 and still available from the University of Georgia Press, An Education in Georgia, the account of Charlene Hunter, Hamilton Holmes, and integration at the University of Georgia. His latest work is a novel published by Random House, Tepper Isn't Going Anywhere, the story of a man who irritates all of New York by reading the newspaper while sitting in his car as it occupies various coveted parking places around the city. I heard only yesterday that the paperback issue of this book will bring him back to Oxford. Maybe you don't know that. We'll look forward to that. A reliable source has it that a local bookstore has sold several hundred copies of his memoir, Messages from My Father, published in 1996, in part due to the fact that each year it promotes it around Father's Day as, quote, perhaps the most telling, eloquent, and moving American memoir of our generation. A friend of mine, Nicholas Davidoff, or Nicky as I call him, in his brilliant biography of his grandfather entitled The Fly Swatter, includes among his sources Messages from My Father, a book that he and I have discussed on several occasions, and he told me that this book was probably more influential in the writing of his book than any other. I emailed him and asked if he had any tips for this introduction. You might note, Nicky wrote me, that Trillin is one of a small company of exemplary American writers, including the likes of M.F.K. Fisher, A.J. Liebling, Joseph Mitchell, and some would add Laurie Collin, whose expertise is not food, but whose excellence at writing about food has made them better known on the subject than any professional food writer. Trillin's great contribution is his appreciation of the glory of low cooking. It is in part because of his prose that we fully appreciate foods like Memphis barbecue and New York Chinese and have embraced them as part of the pantheon of great American delectables. The effort and style and originality of these dishes, their ingredients, those who prepare them, and those who eat them are wonderful prisms through which we can look at the rich, varied cultures that produce them. If we accept the old trope that we are what we eat in a country as complicated as this one, the buffet is pretty complex. Lucky for us, then, to have such a vivid, joyful, and appreciative interpreter and commentator. Signed, Nicky. In summary, Calvin Trillin has made it possible for a bumpkin from Mississippi like me to go to New York and penetrate the complex taxonomy of a Chinese dumpling in the same way that I believe John Edgerton has enabled Jewish Yankees to enjoy barbecue here in the South, or almost do so. As I present him a key to the city, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to Oxford, LaPage County, the University of Mississippi, and the 5th Annual Food Symposium, an American treasure, Calvin Bud Trillin. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Can everybody hear me all right? I'll try to talk loud. It's a great honor to be introduced by a mayor. I don't think that's going to happen to me in New York. Some people accused me of being disrespectful to our last mayor, Rudy Giuliani, because the mayor in Tepper is a vindictive and rigid, irritating man with an Italian name. known as Ducavelli, and he was hoping that the tabloids would call him the Duke, or Duke, conjuring up Duke Snyder or somebody, but actually they call him, because of his policies, Il Duce. And in defending myself for people who wonder how I could have insulted such a man, I say that I was one of the supporters of the mayor after 9/11, and I said at the time that it just goes to show you that there are times when a paranoid control freak is precisely what the occasion calls for. I want to add, as the final speaker, I think it's my duty to add, and my pleasure to add, to thanks to John T. and Mary Beth for what they've done here. Looking back on to see if there are chapters of the history of the University of Mississippi that have brought more glory onto the school. I had to go all the way back to 1959 and 60, when, as many of you know, Mary Ann Mobley and Linda Lee Mead, spoken of then and now as two Kyles from Ole Miss, were Miss America on successive years. And their pictures now are in the Capitol, I believe. Last time I looked, they were still there. And I think it's only a matter of time until John T's picture. It was a long time ago, so I can't remember what Mary Ann and Linda's talent was, as the way the Miss America contest uses the word talent, such as Miss Minnesota will now do her talent. but I know that if they said John T. Edge will now do his talent, that he would, in a cheerful and non-threatening manner, just organize the hell out of the place. I think it's also my duty to summarize to a certain extent and comment on what we've learned this weekend. I want to deal with the one side issue first, and that is the issue of Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta for a year when I was covering the South for Time in the bad old days, so I would consider myself an expert on this subject, and I say now that I am in a judicial position here that I think both John Shelton Reed and Jim Ogmoody were correct. If you'll remember, Mr. Reed's point was that Atlanta had committed what I believe the Atlanta magazine in the 70s or 80s called Bubba side, that they had turned themselves into a soulless, a miserable place. And Jim said that this just reflected the jealousy that Atlanta had out-promoted and out-boosterized the Golden Triangle. I think both of those things are probably correct. Certainly, boosterism in the United States, I believe that Atlanta is the Rome of boosterism. When I lived in Atlanta, every time we passed Five Points, one of the residents would say to me, "Did you know that Atlanta is fourth on the Kremlin's target of nuclear destruction?" This was about 1961 when it was a serious matter, and I don't know which cockamamie civil defense general spoke to the Rotary to get that fact out. And of course you can see the Soviets sitting there thinking, well, we'll get Washington first, and then that will get the government, then we'll get New York, the economic center, and then we'll get the big missile base, and then we'll get Atlanta. That'll take care of a lot of regional sales office and Coca-Cola. And then they'll just fall into our hands. It's very hard to know how to respond to a boast about being fourth target of the Kremlin's massive nuclear destruction. And finally, one day, trying to be a good guest, I said, "I think it ought to be first." This is apparently not the right answer. I'd also like to talk about briefly about Marcy Cohen Ferris's discussion on barbecue and Southern Jews and the laws of kashrut. The people in her part of Arkansas had apparently not heard of what we called in Kansas City the barbecue easement. The barbecue easement was promulgated by the Joplin Rebbe, and the great Rebbe of Joplin, a distinguished Talmudist and pitmaster. What he said that is for Jews who wanted to obey the laws of kosher, that as long as the animal was subjected to low heat, direct heat, for more than 4 hours, they would be allowed to eat any farm animal that did not have scales. He sort of read the Talmud the way Maurice Bessinger read the Bible. As to the question of including lamb, another I consider, I don't mean unimportant, but side issue as opposed to a great theme of the conference. I want to remind everybody that one of the best known of the restaurants in Owensboro, Kentucky, the mutton capital, the barbecue mutton capital of the world, has a sign over the counter saying, "Mary had a little lamb, won't you have some too?" I would say that lamb is in the mainstream as to the novelty items, a side issue on the side issue, prairie oysters and that sort of thing. I have to admit that I am not follower of what I think the intellectuals call Kishka Chic. I'm not interested in all those innards and things. I was once in Hong Kong when I was feeling rather adventurous in a restaurant that had on its menu something called double boiled deer penis. And I thought about ordering it. I was afraid they'd bring it to the table and I'd look at it and say, why don't you take it back and have him boil it one more time? Sauce issue, I think, ran as a kind of a sticky light motif through the whole conference. How much? What's in it? I was very interested in the John Shelton Reed report from Memphis in May that he thought he detected grape jelly in one of the sauces. We have a friend, James Edmonds, who comes up to New York and often cooks my house, brings a chest full of things, and he's lived in New Iberia, Louisiana all his life. He's quite a good cook, but he decided he would seek the counsel of the person whose crawfish etouffee everybody in New Iberia knew was the best crawfish etouffee, a man of impeccable Cajun background, thinking that maybe there was a secret ingredient, some herb that grew only in some season near the Chapalaya Basin spillway. And he checked, and the secret ingredient was Campbell's cream of mushrooms. So he tried it the next time he was at our house, and he said at one point, I think anybody who's sort of sensitive, this would be a good time for them to leave the kitchen. And then you hear, glub, 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 glub. Sauce on the side, I think, was an interesting suggestion, a sort of a Solomonic view of the sauce controversy. There's a barbecue place in Kansas City named LC, which is relatively a recent barbecue place, and my friend Pat Goldberg went in there and called me in New York to report on it. And he said, guy's a real barbecue guy. He said he had asked for a brisket sandwich and then said, would you put the sauce on the side? And LC said, that'll be 50 cents extra. So I think a real barbecue man, of course, is sort of sullen by spending all that time in front of the smoke, I think. And LC certainly fit that rule. I think among the broad things, were introduced by Lola's Eric Eli in his speech that was originally titled Barbecue Geography and then retitled Notes Toward Barbecue Geography and then retitled Notes Toward Barbecue Geography. And I thought that was very interesting. I agree with Lois about most of that stuff. And my own sainted hometown, Kansas City, is actually a mixture of the man who most people think introduced barbecue to Kansas City was a man named Henry Perry, who came from Mississippi, and his great students were the Bryant brothers, Charlie and Arthur, who came from Texas. And that's sort of where Kansas City barbecue came from. But still, it was interesting that Dr. Reed gave a I'm going to call him Dr. Reed. I hope he's got a PhD. You know, you never know about these things. George Shultz is a man with a PhD who used to be Secretary of State, and he's called Mr. Shultz. And Henry Kissinger is a man with a PhD who used to be Secretary of State, and he's called Dr. Kissinger. The only thing I can figure is that maybe Kissinger has a podiatry practice on the side. Anyway, we have these geographic influences, and Kansas City is an example. But Dr. Reed made a good point that barbecue pits local places against. I didn't go much for that grits sticks us together stuff, but that's all right. He wants to do one of those occasionally. It brings out localism, certainly true, and local loyalties. I know when John Hess and his wife, Karen, wrote a book about American food, and part of it was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. They went around the country, and they went to Arthur Bryan's in Kansas City, and they didn't like it at all. And I couldn't understand it, because I thought, my God, these are distinguished people, and they look distinguished. And John Hess has kind of a white beard, but a more distinguished white beard than Wilkie's, a really very distinguished white beard. And the only thing I could think of is when they got to Bryan's, they went up to the counter where Richie, the counterman, pulled a plate with one hand and a handful of ribs with the other. As they approached, Richie looked at them, and they looked so distinguished that he reached under the counter for some tongs that he had last used for a visit of the Emperor Haile Selassie. And what nobody told the Hesses was that about 40% of the taste was in Richie's right hand. And, I mean, Kansas City people have trouble because, I mean, I think everybody has trouble going to a different geographical region if you're used to one kind of barbecue. My eldest nephew, after living all of his life in Kansas City, moved to San Antonio a year or two ago. And when I was in Austin, I met him in Lockhart in to go to Kreitz's and those other German meat market barbecues, which have big signs. At least Kreitz has a big sign saying, no forks, no sauce, no sides. And Kerry got out of the car, and he had some little pack on his belt. And I said, what's that? And he said, bottle of Gates, bottle of Bryan's. And in North Carolina, we've had a lot of trouble in North Carolina. When I get back from a trip to North Carolina and people from North Carolina, we have all sorts of people in New York, people in North Carolina say, how'd you like the barbecue down there? I said, well, it's all right. And he said, well, where were you? And wherever I am, he said, well, No, you have to be, if I was west of Rocky Mount, they always say I had to be east of Rocky Mount, and vice versa. So I decided for somebody who grew up in Kansas City, it's very hard to get on the right side of Rocky Mount in North Carolina. I think that it was very interesting to hear about the political aspect of barbecue, both racial and politics and party politics. I grew up in a segregated city with no signs. And there's some argument about whether Kansas City is part of the South. But it's not exactly part of the South, but the South is part of Kansas City. And realize it, but I was in a legally segregated high school. The restaurants there were white restaurants and black restaurants, and movie theaters were segregated. Both the black high school and the black movie theater were called Lincoln. I always said I was in high school before I realized Lincoln was a man who had been president. I thought it meant color. That's the way they had everything arranged. But everybody went to Bryan's. I've always tried to imagine a scene, and I think I wrote about this in American Pride, of two soldiers who meet in Fort Riley for basic training, white soldier and a black soldier, and they're buddies. And when it gets time to get the first pass into Kansas City, they say, we'll stick together. And they get to Kansas City, and they get to the USO, and the lady says to them, oh, I don't know, well, there's this one little place down in Colored Town. That would be how she put it, I think. And they get down toward Bryant's. Neighborhood's looking worse and worse to this white kid. And they get there, and there's this place, and it's kind of dusty window with five big jugs, dusty jugs of barbecue sauce, the symbol of Henry Perry. And the white guy is thinking, gee, I don't know. But his daddy told him,
color of a man's skin doesn't mean anything. So he's going to walk in with this guy, and he walks in, and lo and behold, he's in the single best restaurant in the world. The first time in the history of the Republic, virtue has been rewarded. He's in Arthur Bryan's. The other guys are eating tasteless chicken fried steak somewhere. So it was part of my background, this racial split. And then, of course, the political split has always been there. I was very interested in presidential food, what influence that is. Lyndon B. Johnson is the one who really did barbecue. I don't know if some of you may not be old enough to remember this, but when Lyndon B. Johnson was in Washington, there was a kind of a smoky haze over Washington. It looked like the British had come back to finish the job. And he was a real barbecue guy. Now, Carter, oddly enough, even though he was from Georgia, was not associated with barbecue. He was associated with grits. And so a lot of people ate grits. In fact, a lot of people still have about two-thirds of a box of grits. left in the pantry. And if you're among them, I just want to help you out that Georgia grits can be used as a substitute in any recipe that calls for wall spackle. And when Clinton came in, I had an editor at the New Yorker who was from Little Rock, and he was quite disappointed that Arkansas culture did not immediately become part of Washington, as had in the past. Arkansas culture is basically based on goobers and coke. Goobers and coke is the sort of Madeleine of people from Arkansas. And he was very surprised. He thought that the Georgetown cocktail parties would people be standing around with 10-ounce coke with goobers in it. I said, well, they don't drink 10-ounce coke to Georgetown cocktail parties. And so he thought maybe there'd be white wine with goobers. I was also particularly taken with Dr. Reed's mention of the quiche ladies embarrassed to live in a barbecue town. This pretty much happened to my hometown of Kansas City, but they were quiche gentlemen in this case. And this was in the late 60s when a lot of American cities had this disease of wanting to be major league cities, both literally have a major league franchise, and then they had a kind of a checklist. You had to have a dome stadium and an international airport. I think, of course, they were using somebody else's tax money to do this, these gentlemen. And I always, when I went around, thought of what the pharaohs could have done if they knew about general obligation bonds. They could have but part of that is they were ashamed of they were ashamed of barbecue. A bunch of people, I think, with really good intentions. In Kansas City, started a sort of a program, really, to turn Kansas City into what they called the glamour city of the 70s. I call them the glamour gang, this crowd. And the thing they hated most was cattle. Kansas City had a reputation as a cow town. When I was a boy, it was called the Heart of America, which I thought was a nice title. But the motto they wanted was, they love this motto, was more fountains than Rome, more boulevards than Paris. That was their motto for Kansas City. I, of course, was safe in New York, lobbing shells back, saying, pointing out that the Kansas City International Airport didn't happen to have any planes that took off from there and landed in a foreign country. They were, And there was a mini, Democratic Party had a mini convention there in the middle 70s, and they were appalled that a lot of people like Walter Cronkite showed up at Bryant's, which had not been on the list of restaurants they had sent to the press. Those lists were made up of the restaurants, and in those days I used to call La Maison de la Casa House. La Maison de la Casa House, comma, continental cuisine. I first thought had to do with the continent of Antarctic because everything started out frozen, but then I decided it had some arcane connection to the Continental Trailways bus company. But they've been supplanted, by the way, by what I think of as sleepy time restaurants, where everything's on a bed of something else. I suggested when I was making these suggestions from the safety of New York that maybe they'd like to take down one of the fountains and use the material to build a memorial to Henry Perry, who had brought barbecue from Mississippi. They didn't like that, the Boosters, and we finally reached a detente about 3 years ago. I gave a speech at the Chamber of Commerce banquet, and I said I probably was misunderstood about dismantling one of the fountains. I said it depended on how many more fountains than Rome we had. If we had only one more fountain than Rome, I was not for dismantling. I didn't want to lose the edge. I didn't want to show up in Rome someday and see a sign, Più Fontani che Kansas City. I think we did reach a sort of detente. I even gave them another slogan I thought would be good, because this was just after they took a study around the United States on obesity in cities and found that Kansas City was number 4. And I thought the reason for that is that the Zagat survey has 38 markets, I think it was then, and they did a survey of cost per meal in the 38 markets, and the cheapest was Kansas City. So I figured what happened is that somebody I'd gone to high school with probably went out to, say, Stroud's Fried Chicken Place, which some of you may know for its wonderful pan-fried chicken and some for its great motto, we choke our own chickens. And they'd order a pretty big dinner. It would all come, and the guy who got the check said, you know, this is really pretty reasonable. So, you know, we could eat a whole other dinner and still not pay as much as we pay in New York. And somebody else would say, well, maybe we could go a little heavier on the gizzards this time. I think another big theme of this conference is that we're uneasy about the future of barbecue. I think a couple of things bother us. I think a little bit is something I discussed when I did a piece on Memphis in May 20 years ago, and that's whether barbecue is in danger of going the way of chili. Chili sort of taken over by people who want it all packaged and self-conscious and a lot of promotion. And I actually went to a chili contest once. Chili contests were actually started when H. Allen Smith, a humorist who two or three people in the room are probably old enough to remember, challenged, I think, Wick Fowler, or did it go the other way around, to a chili contest. Well, it was what?
Challenged Jeff Oliver.
or FX Talbot, and they had a chili, and it's supposed to be sort of mock serious, and of course, the one I went to, which was in Xixiq in Mexico, near Lake Chapalta, I think, or whatever you call that place, it had sort of taken over by people from California. I think sooner or later, almost anything that's any fun in America is going to be ruined by people from California. I mean, one of the problems is in California, I guess it's because of the sunshine or something, people get very, very good at things that aren't terribly important. I came across a bubble blower once in the beach in Venice or Santa Monica or someplace, and he knew the right formula for bubble blowing and the right technique, and he could talk at length about this. But on the whole, I would say bubble blowing is not a terribly important thing. And these people took chili very seriously, to the point where you wanted to say sort of, don't you think you're making too big a deal of this? And I think we have that little worry about barbecue lingering in there. Maybe even at a conference like this, we think in the back of our minds, maybe making too big a deal out of this, and just let the guys cook the barbecue and be quiet. That is, whether barbecue will be edged over the chili line. All promotion, all politicians arguing about whose barbecue is best. And I think another worry we have is a commercial worry. And I think one of the, it was a wonderful question asked that I'm not quite sure it was clear to whoever was on either panel or speaker was asked to. And that is, will calling everything barbecue sort of deteriorate the what barbecue really is? That is, I did a story once on fried chicken someplace. No, I know what it was. I was trying to find a worthy food to represent Kentucky. And I said that a lot of say, students in Kyoto or housewives in Brussels think Kentucky fried chicken is what fried chicken in Kentucky tastes like. And it doesn't. And I think there was a little bit of that worry about barbecue. I wrote in a column, and I'll read you just a paragraph or two. I have a kind of a back and forth on this question. Sometimes I'm very strict on it, and sometimes I think, well, how's it taste? In the mid-90s, someone sent me an article from the Nation's Restaurant News that was headlined, "Equipment Advances Inspire New Breed of Barbecue Operators." The equipment advances referred to being convection ovens, combination steamers, and pressure smokers. The burden of this article was that this new equipment could replace the hickory pit of a traditional barbecue restaurant, resulting in great savings in labor costs, and could also make it possible to add some barbecue items to the menus of restaurants referred to as mainstream operators. A restaurant proprietor was quoted as saying of barbecue, "It's a good add-on, and I think we're going to see a lot of pizza operators taking advantage of the opportunity." I noticed that the restaurant proprietor quoted in the Nation's Restaurant News article was from Minneapolis. The equivalent of quoting a restaurant proprietor in Finland as being pleased at the results of his experiments in trying to develop a new microwave method of making pasta fagioli. I felt like a lover of the old nut who had just read a headline that said, "Use of electric golf carts in cattle herding inspires new breed of cowboy." One thing I know about barbecue is it is not a good add-on or any other kind of add-on. It's the main reason for being there. Another thing I know about it is that I didn't intend to be served any of it by some mainstream operator who also serves pizza and burgers and clown napkins for the kids. A third thing is that saying that labor costs can be held down by not having it cooked slowly over a wood fire by a sullen man with a squint is like saying that a symphony orchestra would be cheaper without the violins. On the other hand, sometimes I think barbecue has to change, as everything else changes. And Barbara Hughes had an enormous staying power when you think about it. I mean, think of in your lifetime all the American foods that have come and gone. Both simple American foods. I've talked a lot about the disappearance of chicken a la king. Now, some of you are old enough to remember when this country was awash in chicken a la king. I mean, when I was doing a series for The New Yorker where I was in a different city every 3 weeks, I often ended up in the Kiwanis Club luncheon trying to talk to the businessmen. And I knew all the words to the song, "I'd Rather Be a Kiwanian Than in Any Other Club." And I actually made up a verse for Chicken a la King, which is, "There's nothing can defeat us, whatever life may bring, because we can go and eat it some chicken a la king." "Oh, I'd rather be a Kiwanian than in any other club." And that was all over. That was a multi-regional, multi-class dish, chicken a la king. When I went to debutante parties on the North Shore of Long Island, and I see somebody looking at me, how does he know what was served at debutante parties? Well, I, as you heard, I went to Yale. My father read a book called Stover at Yale when he was a boy, and he thought I should go to Yale. And I had a lot of people with three last names were there then. My roommate was Thatcher Baxter Hatcher. They didn't call them those names, of course. They had little nicknames like Mutt and Biff. Thatcher was called Tush Hatcher. And he would take me to debutante parties. Around midnight, these snotty-looking waiters would come in with these silver bowls. And in the bowls, midnight, of course, they called that supper. This was 10, 12 hours after everybody in Kansas City had had his supper. In Kansas City, we like to get almost everybody fed before dark. Never can tell what's going to happen after that. And in the silver bowls, chicken a la king. In fact, that's a lot of people think that that's why people from that background talk without... the theory is that goop the chicken a la king used to float around in, that particularly if it has a chemical reaction with silver, if the silver's been in the family for more than three generations, can cause the teeth to bind together. And it's the same is true with sort of high restaurant cuisine. I just sold a poem, if you can say sold a poem, it's not exactly a lot of money, to The New Yorker, which hasn't run yet, which is called What Happened to Brie and Chablis? These things come and go. And here's barbecue going right straight on. So I'm after this weekend, I'm sort of optimistic about barbecue, and I think people here are optimistic about it. I think particularly when I heard Van Sykes talk, I thought he's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to preserve something in a way that allows him to run a business, which is exactly what we're trying to do here. It's not otherwise you'd have barbecue in those sort of demonstrations you get in Williamsburg. I'm not really interested in who cuts Mr. Sykes' wood. I think as long as he supervises the wood, that he could let somebody else cut it. And I'm sort of optimistic because eventually it's what it tastes like. That's what all this gets down to. The last time I went to Kansas City, Doug Wargle, who's written a book on Kansas City barbecue, said, well, let's go eat some barbecue. And I said, all right, I'm going to come home. And he said, I think we should go to a place called Oklahoma Joe's. Oklahoma Joe's breaks all of my rules for Kansas City barbecue. First place, run by a white man. And I've always said that traditions differ, in various parts of the country, but in Kansas City, going to a white-run barbecue is like going to a Gentile internist. I mean, things might work out, but you're not playing the percentages. You really are. And he's not only white, but he came from the barbecue contest background, which worthy thing, but for people who like it. And mainly white people, I have to say, who like it. But not where I would expect. I expect a barbecue guy to have kind of apprenticed at 14 in the way maybe Paul Bocuse went to work in a French kitchen in Lyon at 14, something like that. Also, this was in the suburbs. He claimed it wasn't in Johnson County. Johnson County is what Richard Rhodes once called Cupcake Land. It's the suburbs of Kansas City, Missouri. So he broke a lot of my rules. And I went there and I said, well, come on, there's pennants for the guy who won the contest and all that stuff. And he's got North Carolina barbecue. And we had a pulled pork sandwich. And I said, finally, this is a pretty good sandwich. The proof is in the tasting. And last night, I was having trouble obeying the admonition of Miss Piggy. One of the ways I try to follow the St. Thomas Aquinas notion of moderation in all things. This may be the only time St. Thomas Aquinas and Miss Piggy have been mentioned in the same sentence. But I was trying to follow what I follow Miss Piggy's admonitions in a lot of areas of life, and one of them is this. And Miss Piggy, you may remember, said, "Never eat more than you can lift." And I was having difficulty because it was so good, and particularly when I ate Mr. Mitchell's North Carolina barbecue, and I realized that after all these years, I had finally ended up on the right side of Rocky Mountain. Thank you very much.